We're having a very special moment of a roundabout podcast. It is kind of all about Counter-Strike podcast turned into Star Series here as we're getting a very special treat. I've got access to Navi's Alexi B and Ninjas in Pajamas Snappy. Welcome, boys. How are we doing?
Doing good.
Yeah?
Thanks.
Smiles on the faces, but games haven't begun just yet, so we'll come back to that afterwards. This mini podcast is going to be looking at everything to do with being an IGL, all the things you guys have to go through, educating the world on how some of it goes down. But the first thing I want to go through is just becoming an IGL. So I want to start with you, Snappy, on how it came to be. At what point did you decide on it? Why?
I think I came back because I was not playing for a few years at the start when it transitioned from 1.6 to CSGO.
Yeah.
I was playing a bit from netcafes for the first 3 years, but I didn't own a PC for the majority, and I was just focusing on uni and my job. And then I came back and I played for, I think, a year or so. And then we were lacking an in-game leader and my team kind of wanted me to give it a try. And then I kind of like stayed in that role since. I think it was when I joined, I think Heroic maybe. Okay. It was my first full time. I quit my job and went full time again. And yeah, it worked out.
Kind of got thrusted upon you, not really a direct choice?
No, it wasn't a direct choice. It was definitely like teammates wanting me to take the role.
For you, Alexi, you were young when you started off as an in-game leader. How did it come about?
I think it was more natural because we just had a friend group, or not necessarily. We kind of created it by just having this certain group of players. And then when it got more serious, or even when we were playing for fun, I was usually just the one who were trying to win and trying to say where we should go because other people weren't doing it.
Okay.
But then when it got a bit more serious, it was just always natural for me to guide. Mm-hmm. But once I got a chance in 2016 for trial period in ENCE,
yeah,
I wasn't the IGL, or probably I was, but they were like trying to see like how I fit when the other guys were calling.
Yeah.
And then they were encouraging me to do it, and since then it was like I just approached it always by trying to be the IGL. Before that it was just like, you know, otherwise we're running around on the server, so it was just better for us to group together and do something, you know.
Do you feel like you naturally had the personality to be a leader in that sense?
Yeah, I do think so. Like now looking back to everything, like I see that it's way more likely that you are not going to do it and you're focusing on yourself, or, you know, playing with two pre-mates and not speaking to the others. So some people have the quality to, you know, do it more efficiently, I guess.
Was it natural for you, or did it take some time to get into, like adjust to it?
I think it was natural when I took it up. But people also have to realize back in 1.6, I wasn't full-time ever. Like, I didn't go full-time until 2015 or 16. So before that, I was more playing as a hobby, I would say. But when I transitioned fully into the in-game leading role, it was natural. But I don't think I saw it myself before, if it makes sense.
Okay, so it's more like as it happened, then you saw, okay, I can do this.
I think so.
What is it that tells you can be the person that would be an IGL, right? Because we've seen many star players have tried to IGL, other players have gone, and then we quickly see it doesn't work out. How do you understand this?
I think you need to have certain qualities. Some of them might be seen negative, but I think you need a certain stubbornness to be the in-game leader, because you also need to kind of hold on to your own ideas, not for everything in the world, but if you're too easy to push around, it's like people see stubbornness as a negative thing. Mm. But I think in-game leaders do need a little bit of it. Not so it's like impossible to work with, but you definitely need to at least be able to hold your own in that regard. And then I think empathy for players is also an important thing. Like being able to feel your players and encourage them, and also know when they're not feeling good. And you know, I think some of these qualities is something you need to have to be a good leader.
Yeah, I think a very underrated aspect, because no one else will ever know.
Yeah.
You know, like these things are only stuff that you will go through with your teammates. And maybe like once you join another team, someone messages you after or something, like they, you know, you have these discussions with certain individuals that exactly like when they're not feeling good and they appreciate it and you go back and forth, but this is nothing that no one will ever know, basically. And I think it's very underrated, and it, I think it's a huge aspect in terms of longevity of the lineups and, you know, overall the team to feel like a team.
Can it be more emotionally draining on you guys when you have to take this kind of role as well as not just the in-game leader, but also some of the outside bits of teammates?
Yeah, I would say so. But I also think that's kind of required to be a good in-game leader. I think that players trust you a lot more when you can kind of catch them, like be their sometimes parachute in a way. And I also think that's what makes them respect you, that they know that you have their best interest. Because as an in-game leader, I think the best in-game leaders usually put their players above themselves. It can be too much. I've tried myself to do it too much.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to at least have their back.
Is it a lot of balance between like learning this though, right? Because people can be so critical of an IGL of what they see on stats or what they're doing on the server. There's so much more going on, right? And you've got to do some testing at the same time.
Yeah, I think that I've only learned whenever I, you know, at one point I was changing teams all the time. And I was also thinking that, what can I do better? And what were my lessons? Like, what did I learn? And exactly what you're saying. Sometimes you're doing too much. Sometimes you're doing too little. And at some point, like, I know you're working with trolls, for example, but sometimes you have people in the staff or people in the team that can do something for you. So, for example, why I bring him up is, like, he can also take charge of speaking to the players. So you don't need to be that emotionally invested, like, all the time. So it's very good that they also get help somewhere else and they're not, you know, always thinking that you're having an eye on their back. Like, someone else is doing it as well.
Yeah. How is it in terms of managing relationships between you and these players if you need to have a tough conversation? Is it good to have someone also outside from, like, the main five players, even maybe the coach as well, like, outside of that, to keep the mood good, to keep things on an even keel?
Yes and no, because I also think it's your responsibility to take the tough conversations at times. And I also think that is what makes the players respect you at times, that you are there when it's tough, but you're also there when, like, you're there when it's good and when it's bad in a way, right? Yep. Obviously, there is certain times where staff needs to take over, as you say, and, like, there's a reason why people have sports psychologists, coaches, assistant coaches, right? So it's about trusting and delegating as much responsibility as you can, but there's certain things I think you kind of have to do yourself.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that having played in so many teams, I see that in some teams it's different. And for example, like, I think the whole community knows, like, everybody respects Blade, especially like when you work with him when you're in the team. So obviously he has a big say and a big, huge amount of respect from the players. So when he speaks to you, you listen, you go back and forth with him. And I'm there also, but it's like in another team, this might not be the case, you know? There was no one. So I was usually the guy who was speaking to everyone. So I'm always kind of aware by my surroundings and trying to understand, like, what's the function of the team? Like, how should everything go? And I think that here in Navi, at least, we find a good balance of it. And at some points I felt like I was lost when there was, like, no one else really there to help me. So I've been in a lot of teams now. And like you said, it's still hugely important that someone's doing it.
Yeah.
Looking at the difference between what we were talking about as a real leader, like, because the way I see some teams, and you can tell me if you've had it in any of your teams as well, is there's some people who are leaders in-game and captains, but then there's some people who lead the team in-game. And there's almost like a captain with more of the personality persona that would be a leader in that sense, right? How important is that for that to be just the one person? And can it work with having both ways?
I think it can work with both. I think it also comes down to ego a lot.
Yeah.
I think my coach Exist had it work like that, where he was more of the in-game leader, and then you had other people outside the game that maybe took more of the other responsibilities. But I also think that comes down to him having not the biggest ego, so therefore he was fine with other people taking the spotlight. So even though he was probably the real captain, like other people could be it outside the game maybe. So I think it can definitely work, but it's also a thing with personalities. Like, I don't think a lot of people actually want to do the duties you have to outside of the game because people want to just play CS.
Yeah,
I think everything will work as long as the whole team trusts it. Mm-hmm. So it can be another guy, it can be the IGL, but it needs to be a thing where it's kind of like everybody knows it without saying it. So like, as long as you follow one thing and as long as you understand, like, it's not a surprise that someone's doing it like someday and this guy's doing it the other day. And then, like, you know, I heard like teammates like Config, you probably know, like, sometimes I felt like he was there when the team needed it, you know. Okay. And he wasn't like the usual guy who's like always the captain or something, but he could have this moment when he's like, you know, making a speech or something and everybody listens, everybody understands at that moment that's what we needed, basically.
Yeah.
So for me, it's like, as long as the whole team follows and as long as like everybody understands how it works, it can work. Yeah. Why not?
It just needs to feel natural.
Yeah.
As you say, I think the worst, if it feels forced,
yeah,
then it feels wrong.
Yeah, you don't want it to be fake. Now, looking at IGLs and coach relationships, for me, I think this is incredibly important, but maybe it doesn't get seen as enough credit. Like, for example, you were mentioning about Blade and how it works, but have you ever been in a situation where you know a team's not going to work because you can't gel or can't work with your coach? Like, how much do you guys value that?
I would say it matters. Yeah, you can go.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very important. And it's, the thing is that sometimes you might not, you know, mesh together the best. Like, I've had plenty of coaches this far, and sometimes you understand that maybe you're not the best buddies or anything, but if you can work with each other,
yeah,
like when it comes down to CS, when it comes down to speaking what you want to do, coming up with ideas, whatever, you can always work. But if you hold grudges, if you, you know, show like passive aggressiveness, like creating drama, this is when there's going to be, you're not going to be on the same page. And when the whole team feels that the IGL and the coach are not on the same page, you can already understand what's about to happen.
No, I 100% agree. I think generally I had coaches I got along with. But obviously there is coaches where you think you see more eye to eye with them. And I think that's obviously easier to work with, because at the end of the day, when you're in a coach in-game leader relationship, it's kind of like a give and take. Mm-hmm. And you need to kind of come to a middle ground or go on one guy's ideas, right? So it's obviously a lot easier if you're kind of somewhat aligned, because yep, then that middle ground is probably the way both player and coach want to approach things, right?
How does it work with agreeing on that, though? Like, which way to go? Say you want to play this way, the coach's system or idea is this way. Like, that must be a difficult conversation.
Yeah, but I think some constellations just don't work. I also have experienced sometimes where I've had lineups where we might agree on a playstyle if we had a certain lineup, mm-hmm, but then because of, let's say you have a young lineup with not a lot of firepower, with a lot of firepower but bad comms, or you have a very experienced lineup but with weak firepower, I think this is where I've tried where we maybe didn't come fully to the same conclusion on how to play, because I think you need to kind of adapt your style to the players at the end of the day. You will have your own style still with you, but you need to be able to approach it depending on what personnel you have available.
Yeah, and I've had bigger arguments, like when it comes down to this, like sometimes it's both of you are so frustrated about a situation that you basically like don't really reach a conclusion, and the other person is like, oh, let's do it your way, you know, in like this like bad manner. And like,
but it's not really supported. So
yeah, exactly. And if it works, then you kind of just like roll with it. You try it on practice. Let's say you do it on the game plan. And if it doesn't work, then it's not like the other person is saying like see what happened, like not like this, but you understand like okay, maybe you were wrong. And then like the next time you bring it up, you kind of know that, okay, let's do it the other way, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's like, you know, I might disagree with someone and at the end I'm like, it's such a small like detail that let's just do it this way, like in a normal manner.
Okay.
But it just depends on the situation. And I think it's like, if you're a part of a tier one team, it'll happen. Like if that never happens, that like you're working with yes men or like who will never say if something is bad, or, you know, like eventually you'll always be incorrect at some point. So
is there a lot of like one-to-one time between IGL and coach? There's like a lot of that sit down time to go through things.
I think it depends on the team and depends like how you want to work. Like I've had teams where I do one-on-one and then we show it to all the other players without really like asking them too much, sometimes asking like opinions and then creating it and showing to them. And I've had teams where we're just all together. But basically, usually it's more of key players trying to fix details on their part. Sometimes there's fully open keys to a player, like I'm not even taking charge at all, because I know that they have like, let's say Connector on Mirage, like I'm not gonna say to, if I'm bringing up something new, yeah, if I'm not, this guy probably watching, you know, demos of other Connector players is saying like, I don't want to do this, I want to do it this way. And it's like, what should I say? Like, if it's within the realm of our approach to the game, it's like, whatever, these are small details that every player should do on their position if they understand that, you know, they're not taking huge space or something. And if they want to create something new, so be it. It's like, this is how meta changes, like players are creative.
Now, I want to talk about a bit more on the coaching side. It's like for you, right? Blade has his system. So when you came into that, is it just got to adapt to that system and you got to follow by that? Or how does it work with your own ideas coming in there? Because that's interesting to me, because everyone talks about Blade's system. That's never saying like, this is Alexi's system, for example.
No, I think that he was very, like now when I think about it, like now when, you know, we've had Drin join us, Makaze, join us, it's way different because we already have everything set and like countless of hours of repetitions and speaking about different situations. But when I joined with JL and Ima,
yeah,
I think that he took a step back as well. Like I remember the first boot camp, it was like he just wanted to feel us. Like I was calling whatever. He was always saying like they had a, every top team had, you know, how to apps pop on Inferno, how to apps pop on this map and that map. And it's like, I was calling, let's say, an apps pop and calling the roles on the fly, let's say. And then he's understands the playbook they used and after the game would say like, we did this now in this practice. I think it's going to be good. It's like part of the meta still, but let's have these roles. We were running it. It was working. It's like, basically, at first, I felt like he took a step back and analyzed how the players feel each other, how the players speak, and started building more and more. And maybe he also wanted to review the Navi playbook at that point because everything was fresh. So it was a lot of new ideas by even other players.
Okay.
And then, but eventually, like, it was the blueprint for him.
Yeah.
And, you know, after that, it's just been, like I said, we played together for a long time now, 2.5 years or something, or over 2 years now for me. So it's a lot of the stuff is how he visions it. And he's like very good at taking all the notes, remembering what the previous teams were doing and, you know, always trying to be on top of the meta. And yeah, also allowing the players to be creative and allowing me to be creative as well.
Nice. And for you on like, you have your way of playing, but is it always a middle ground? Did you have a system thrown at you, or like maybe did Saw have a way where he said, I expect this?
I think like when it comes to Saw, I think me and him Saw very much alike.
Okay.
So what I think it is actually, as Alexi say, more where I would say most coaches actually give the in-game leader a lot of freedom to kind of approach the role. And then at least the best coaches, I would say, gives the in-game leader a lot of freedom, because whether you like it or not, the coach can only talk three times for 30 seconds. So the in-game leader needs to be comfortable, I would say even more than the coach, because he's the one who needs to sit and play and talk for 50 minutes. And the coach has 1 minute and 30. So a lot of his work is more done in the background, challenging the in-game leader more on his ideas, finding the in-game leader's blind spots, improving every player to maximize what they have in their role. But I think, as Alexi say, I think mostly they will at the start probably sit a little bit back and see how it develops and then try to improve it like 10%, because I would say the coach's job is obviously to keep the group together, but it's also just to change those 5%, and especially for me as an in-game leader, help my blind spots, because you maybe create your own system, you maybe think this and this works together, but then maybe he sees, but because this player over here is doing this and you're doing that, then it becomes obvious for the enemy. So like finding these small things where you maybe don't see it yourself, or you maybe need some months to realize. I think this is kind of how it is.
But like, just to add on to it, it's like when I compare to anything previously on my career, it was a, not sure how should I describe it in English, but it was a surprise to me that he was so keen on in-game details. And then I understood that, like this is how it's going to work. And I kind of also, like when I was changing these teams, I also understood like I need to adapt as well. I can't like keep going to every team and just do the same things. Like I always try to learn something. And in Navi, I understood that he wanted to stay on top of the meta all the time. And he was very keen on, he wasn't playing the game, was constantly watching the game and analyzing.
So much,
so it's like compared to other coaches I've had, it's like I had all the keys to do everything. And in this team, I understood it's way better for me to adapt and to understand that let's try it this way. And, you know, like after that, it was history. Like I started to feel more comfortable, and I always had someone on the side who was taking so much from the in-game aspect, like by speaking to players, like keeping everyone in check, that it was just a new experience. And I thought that, you know, sometimes you need to adapt as well.
Yeah, but I guess he challenged small parts constantly.
Yeah, exactly. Reading, right? But yeah, it's like I've had like a lot of coaches who is more on, as you said, keeping the team, you know, vibes, chemistry, all this stuff, like speaking one-on-one after practice, like someone is not feeling good, and less the in-game details. And I was like huge part of the in-game details. And it's now it's kind of a bit of both, but we have other stuff in Navi who is working more about like outside game related.
Yeah. There is always this conversation around coaches that are more the motivational coaches and then more the in-game ones. So what you're saying there, right, about Blade having this focus on the in-game details, how is it best for you guys to have coaches? What do you prefer? Like, does it depend on the team you have? Does it depend on the way you want to be? Do you want a balance of it?
I mean, I think it's best if coaches are obviously good at both. But I would say
it's very rare, right?
Yeah, I think like there's becoming more and more good coaches in the space. I think it's also a development with the game. I think when it started, there wasn't probably a lot because everyone was still playing, right?
Exactly.
But I think with time, there's going to be more and more good coaches. It's going to develop. And I think especially like as Alexi said, like, getting challenged on the small details is what improves you. Because also, as I said, with, for example, Saw, he would challenge small details on me. And this is kind of what made me also better, for example, back in ends.
Yeah, and trust me, like, I've probably gotten myself kicked by the fact that once you sit on the server with the players for so many hours outside, whatever, you're always the guy who is pinpointing mistakes. Or always the guy who is doing the most annoying job. Like you just lost a tournament, you go back home to practice, and you're the one, again, coming up with the mistakes.
Yeah. You
know, 1,000 times to the same player, maybe the fifth time he does the same mistake. And it's like, they will lose it with you. Like they start to be annoyed and stuff. But someone needs to do it. Like you can't just stop doing it, right? So it's like having that burden shared, or that another person can do it, because I've had coaches who never did it, and it's like and I'm speaking about in-game details, not like this player has a bad mood, yeah, he might go and fix it, but in-game details, like if the coach wasn't that, like never fixing the in-game stuff, he will not start to do it after a year. Like he's...
That's not his way.
More and more like getting away from it. So I think that now I've learned that it's very valuable to have the chemistry better and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, going into the future and how I see it, I think that coach just needs to understand the game. If the coach understands the game, I think it's very good that he's also invested with the details. But if you have a coach that, let's say the IGL, like let's say you understand the game, you think you understand it much better than him, yeah, and he's like providing everything, you might get tilted yourself, right? So it needs sure. to there needs to be a fine line. And like, I think in the future, you're going to have more coaches that played on the top for, let's say, 10 years and also understand a lot, like as long as they don't stop watching.
It's interesting as well, because obviously I know Blade doesn't play anymore, right, at the top, but he watches so much, like he's watching everything. But is it a must that a coach must be not actively playing, but actively seeing all this stuff? Or
I think it's not a must that he's playing, but it's definitely a must that he's spending pretty much the same time as the players. But he will do that naturally by sitting in on practice alone. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a lot of hours there, watching other games, staying on top of the meta. Obviously, sometimes I think the coach will also realize how the players are peaking certain angles if he has a mind for the game. So I don't think it's a requirement to still play as long as you have played on a very high level. But I do think it is probably at this point, I think it is actually hard maybe to be a top tier level coach without having played on a somewhat decent level at least. Because you do need to understand the game like very good in order to fix small details, like fix small, like just a flash being like 10 centimeters longer in order to, you know, take more angles, or a player like when he strafes, like does need to, like different situation requires different movements from the player. And these small details, I think a high level coach needs to be able to also address, as you say.
Yeah.
Now moving on from coaches, something you both have had to do a lot over your careers, incorporating new players, rookies to teams. Just tell me the way you have to approach this and how you look at it. Because if we're specifically looking at a rookie, right, they can have the best aim in the world, but then coming to tier one is maybe not as easy, or it's a harsh reality for them. And then getting them into systems, getting them into being led in the right way. So how do you start doing this?
I think for me, it's that, like I've had plenty of rookies coming to my team. And like ever since Sergei coming to Habu, Mantu, Hetrick, Monesi.
Yeah.
And
forget about that time.
Yeah. And I think I'm missing someone. But anyways.
You actually leveled up a lot of AWPers just thinking about this.
I don't... For me, it's like, if a rookie like that,
yeah,
you bring him to any team, he was already brought there by the fact that he was, you know, 14, 15 and like dominating. So I don't... Even if I was there or not, like I'm not going to take credit from that, because okay, I think that player already had everything to become better, and he's going to only become better once he starts playing with the like a better team, right? But the thing is that, again, I'm coming back to the fact that like who's in the team.
Yeah.
Like if you have now Makase coming to us, Blade will help him a lot. I will help him a lot. You know, Monesi, Nico kind of took him under his wing. Like we could see in the future as well, like how they've developed his... There's a lot of these minor details, but as the IGL, you always want to be there to try and make them comfortable. Like the number one thing is being comfortable and having those encouragement words, like understanding, let's say he had a bad game or whatever, you can always go to him and like speak about your experience, because you've been there, had the experience. Maybe you didn't get brought up to the tier one team like being a star, but you're kind of the voice. And they will listen to you, hopefully.
What about for you, Snappy?
I would say it's also hard. What is a rookie really like? Is it a player that have played in tier two, tier three, and then comes into a team? Or is it a player that you pick straight out of face it, like a Spinks guy, for example? Like it's hard to kind of say what is a rookie. But I would say that one of the most important things when you are a rookie is to look for their mindset. Like, are they willing to kind of learn? Are they stubborn? I think, especially also when you do scouting for mm-hmm. these things, it's important that the players that you bring is like, they need to have a certain mindset and curiosity towards the game and towards the players that they play with. And I think if they have this, it's kind of like a straight line in how you develop them. But there will be bumps on the road, and sometimes you make the rookie or the new player comfortable, and then suddenly you have two other players that became uncomfortable in the process,
yeah,
right?
It could happen.
And this is something that we have experienced here in NIP, but also me in past teams where you try to facilitate one player, and then suddenly two other guys are saying, "Yeah, but now I'm uncomfortable."
Yeah.
Right? So it's like it's always a balance, and then you need to address that part, which means that you sometimes have to take a little bit space away again from the rookie, but then you reach a compromise. And I think by repetition and like talking and figuring out, okay, what can we then do in order to solve it, you find a middle ground where everyone can find somewhat comfort. You won't always reach it that everyone gets it. Usually it's the in-game leader who have to accept that yeah. I'm just a bit uncomfortable, but it's fine.
This is my life.
Yeah, but you are kind of the last person that gets that focus, right? So
yeah. Looking at from rookies to players that maybe have a voice or maybe have too much of a voice, how do in-game leaders manage this? Like, are you both the same? Do you like a lot of extra talk and input from your teammates, or do you prefer it not to be there? Is there a golden rule? Do you both have different ways?
It very much depends on the player. There's some players where I like it a lot, and then there's some players that think they're good at it, but they're not. I think that's actually a very common thing, that players think that they're really good at certain things, like this area specifically, and they yap, and they're not really good at it. So I would say that it depends. There's certain players where I really like it. Some players are really good at coming with ideas, and you really want to listen to them. Mm-hmm. I would say that, for example, like when I was in Ents, like I had Nerdsons and Pius that was really good at like coming up with ideas. Like some Pius was the kind of guy where you had to kind of limit him because he would watch 1,000 demos and you would kind of have to find the
information
10,
overload.
Instead of having the 50 things he came with, you would have to pick the 10 best, but it was really nice to have a guy like that.
Yeah.
And then for a guy like Nerds, for example, he was just very comfortable with his plates, so you could trust him and trust his like mid-rounding, like in term, like not for the team, but around himself. It was more okay. Like, I want to do this. Okay, then we've built a plan around it, right? Okay. So that's the kind of input I like. But then obviously you can also have players that are just taking a lot of space, but not really, because you also, when you take that, you also need to give something to the team, right? I think it's a balance. So there's certain players that are good at it, and those you want to just, you know, like, encouraged to do it more.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that there was a couple of very good points that I didn't even think about. Like some players like to do pace, like off of spawn or off of mid game. Like they kind of like create the whole round, not just like information that like this guy on B doesn't have any more smokes. You know, that's like an idea, like an info that could be crucial, but some people don't do it. But like you used Nerds in this example, like I've had players who are saying, like building the whole, like how he's going to peek something and you're going to pop there. Like that's the whole round already built or something. Like it's always good to have those people. And I really like it if they do it on practice and then they also do it on official.
Okay.
Because I've had those players that do the biggest moves on practice, but you never feel that they're going to do it on official. And that's like, you kind of want to tell them that, bro, please, like, it's very good what you're doing now. Like, just have the balls to do it on official.
Yeah.
It's going to be very good.
Yeah.
But the thing is that if you want to build, like, a system that works long-term, it's very good if the side players, if playmakers, that they constantly have a voice and have understanding. Because nowadays, the meta and, like, the setups and the understanding people have out of, like, already what util they hear, like let's say ancient mid is a very good example. Like the mid guy on T side, already by the util that's thrown mid, could understand if he watched at all like what the opponents were doing, like are they fighting for mid or not, and like what the possibilities are. And let's say I'm in highway on B and it's like nades, extinguishing everything, and I'm not really capturing what's happening, and this guy's not saying it or not instantly saying that we should do this or that, you're running into brick walls at times because you're trying to, you know, call around or do around, and this guy 15 seconds ago already understood what to do in order to outplay them, right? So it's a very hard topic, I feel like, because as you said, someone could yap too much or like doesn't really understand. But at the end of the day, if you want to build something, you can't only rely on one guy. You can't even rely on two guys. You need the whole team to function and everyone to understand, like when a guy says he's going to take space, they need to start immediately pressuring with utility. No questions asked. If the whole map is silent, someone on the opposing team is going to say, care this. And then they catch the guy. It's like so many small details, and like in tier one, all these details matter, I think.
But it is very much also about trust, as you say. Ancient mid, for example, like as an in-game leader, you are not in control of what actually happens on mid. Your T player on that, the main T guy that goes out mid, like some guy might be holding flashes for him, but it's not my responsibility whether he goes out or not always. Like it's a split second decision from him. And you need to have a player there that understands that, and you, as next, you have the balls to actually, you know, make the right moves in the official, right? And also on the stages, because you, as an in-game leader, let's say usually an in-game leader goes maybe close cave, you have no clue if he's about to go out or not. Like it's his decision, and you need to get that responsibility for the players. And so some are good at it and some are not. And it's also about success rate, because some players are just so skilled, they can get away with 55%. Like if you have about 50% good plays, it's nice, right? But if you have a guy that controls a lot but just dies a lot, it's equally not nice. So it's very much a balance, and I mean this is also where the best players are firing, right?
Yeah.
So yeah.
How does it work with micromanaging? Because I remember back in your OG days, there was a time where we'd heard voice comms back at that time, right? Where Alexi, you're almost dead, but you're leading everything that they're doing part of the round, part of the round. Is micromanaging an important factor for an IGL, or is it a mix? Is it freedom? What are we looking at?
I think it's actually important to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think it's important to try and minimize it as much as possible.
Okay.
Stuff you can make agreements to, or like stuff that the player on their own can get to a conclusion that is correct, is better than the in-game leader microing everything, because people are so good these days that a lot of the things are split-second reactions. So obviously you will need to micro certain stuff if you want to hit a side mid-round in a 3v3 or 4v3 or whatever, and you have certain parts or certain utility. And especially if you're dead as an in-game leader, it's super easy to do it, right? But that's the kind of micromanagement you want to get to. But I also think you want to leave a lot of it out so that players have the freedom to do the correct plays, and that you can play and get in a lot of the same situations, because repetition of situations is also what creates comfort and creates like confidence in the players to be able to do the moves that they need to do. So it's important to be able to do it, but it's also, I think, equally important to try to avoid it happening too much that you need to do it.
Yeah, I think that it is very important, and I've always had the thought about it, that if the people who are alive, or like let's say I'm dead and I'm spectating, if the people who are alive are creating ideas or they are speaking already, I don't need to say anything. I feel like they have it under control. And sometimes you spectate, or I might be alive, and the guy who's dead, I think he has equal responsibility to understand like the situation. If I'm not saying something, they might see something. They also died, so they understand how this, let's say on T side, how the cities will react based off of his death. So there is a lot of good players are doing it, and you can hear it in the booths as well, like when you walk around, like not the viewers cannot, but like the competitors can. And when you hear these international teams, and I've heard a lot of good rifle players as well, or even opers, like for example Torzy, like these guys, the good players understand when to talk, when to micro, and it's very important, I think. But there's always a line to everything. I'm not saying sometimes I, you know, went overboard with it. At some points I wasn't doing it. And at one point I'm thinking like, maybe I should do it more. It's a never ending thing. And I think that when you play with the right guys, or when there is a flow and communication is rolling, you don't really need to do it because someone's already kind of doing it. And, you know, I notice it that in good teams I've played, good players are doing it. Like, let's say, good example, like Valera, for example. He's very good at, like, let's say he's spectating. And he understands, like, I'm one step away from the guy I should trade. He is saying to, like, he can say the first guy, like one step, you know, like, just, it's micro, but it's important.
Yeah.
Then let's say he loses the one step. He starts a duel. I'm insta-trading him. Just a random example, by the way. But it's like, good players are doing it constantly. And it's important.
Yeah, I think actually the better the teams I've played in, the less I have to micro, for sure.
Okay.
So it's actually a good, like, for sure, the better the team is, the less you micro.
Also the communication part. And in OG, I think that at the start of Navi as well, it was very tough with the communication for, I mean, Simple had experience, but Bit didn't have any experience. And we also, like, came from other backgrounds with JL and Ima. And in OG, for example, we just created an international lineup. So at first, also the communication aspect is important. And I think, you know, from Danish teams, I know from Finnish teams, it's like everything's obviously much more easy.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, even for good English speakers, like, the native language will always be 10% faster.
It's, yeah.
It's just like, just explaining just around the corner, you know, just saying it in your own own language.
Give me half a second faster. Give me the difference. What would it be? No. Just around the corner in Danish?
No, like, just around the corner, but in Danish it would be like, and it would be so quick, and they would get it insta.
That's,
like, you know, it is like half a second, but that's also why, obviously, if you had equal, like, if all the best players was from, you know, one country, they would for sure mega dominate, because it would, like, make a difference, I think. But the advantage of the international teams is you can just get all the best players for the roles you need, right?
But, and this is it, right? We're looking at, you both started on national teams and now you're both away from it. We've got Astralis, right? You've got some of the Russian-speaking teams as well. But can, like, European, American CS survive without being international?
Yeah, I do think so, but it would kind of need, every time, for there to be a national team that's good enough, there would kind of need to be like a golden generation in one country.
Yeah, like, and where they just keep coming up in each role.
Yeah, I think if there's enough good players in a country, for sure, like, because I think what you get with the international team is you get, like, better players. But if you have, like, let's say 95% of the skill in a national team, I think they could easily match up, right? But that's the thing. Not a lot of countries, except for the CIS ones, do have that. Like,
yeah.
Brazil. Yeah. They kind of have, like,
They're going away from it now. They start speaking English.
They just need to get it in one place, right?
Maybe that's true.
But I remember their difference is they cannot buy the players to put the right team because of the dodgy contract.
Like, I remember at first there was so many Swedish teams. Yeah. Then, like, there was the Danish era where I felt like the major had, like, 30 Danish players.
Yeah,
and, like,
crazy.
That's where I felt like you could create, like, Astralis 2.0, like, from all these other players that are on this teams. Like, the major had like 5 or something Danish teams. So it's like, now it's way less. Like, I don't know really what happened, maybe exactly what you said about the age of people and stuff, but there is not really, like, I'm trying to think, like, of a nationality, like, all kind of dropped.
I think Turkey is a good example of having, like, a lot of good players right now in that over team, right? But even that, like, they probably have some roles where they could upgrade, right? But
and you've always got to have that next generation coming through all the time.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Ukraine and Russia are the two biggest, but they could for sure field a team each that would be top 5 in the world if they get at all of the players.
And I think some of these teams that are coming up are, like, they're just almost there to be, like, very good. They also lack the fact that the best, like, players might be already in some teams, and they will never join the team to, you know, fill the gaps or stuff like
that.
Give the wisdom, you know, all this stuff. It's like a never-ending cycle, I feel like. Like, once the international teams are formed, it's very hard to go national again. Like, all the stars need to align.
Yeah.
And the national organizations need to pull out all the money.
Yeah, a lot of money at that point when it happens.
Our contracts have made it very hard. And also, I think in general, like, if a team have like a superstar player, like if a nationality have a superstar player, that's what you want to build around. But that's kind of the things that Sweden don't have it at the moment, Denmark don't have it at the moment, Finland don't have it at the moment. Like there's none of these, like France probably do have it, but they have they're number one in the world with an international lineup, right? But the majority of the nationalities, they just don't have that firepower to match, because you can see it in Astralis, like it's a good team, right? But they don't have a top 10 player in the world, probably not even top 20
player.
They
didn't have a top 20 last year, so there was none.
So then it's just hard to compete, because you're going to be playing against, you know, some of the other teams that just have players that are straight up more individually skilled, right?
Okay, away from the player side and the country side, because it was a nice interesting tangent as you guys were talking about national. Second callers in a team, the extra voice in there. Is it a must to always have that dedicated second person? Is it always like a requirement for you?
I think I already kind of answered this. I think not. I think that the responsibility should be bigger on everyone. Like, it's easier, like, we were speaking about responsibilities, like whether it comes to like a mid player on Ancient, but like it's easy to give the responsibility for someone so he always has it at the back of his head and you can remind him. But it's also very good if, I'm just trying to imagine like Prime Astralis. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was watching their voice comms. You obviously know better, but I just felt like the whole team understood the game. They understood the moves that is always the best.
How to play
with each other. Like all of them could maneuver the whole team and they could say something and the whole team is rotating and like offering the perfect util. It's like always
the dreams are not right.
No, but it's like, that's for sure the case. And now when Vitality was rolling everyone the start of the year, I do feel like when you were watching them, like the cohesion of everything.
Oh, definitely.
And they knew their roles, they knew the responsibilities. Like I think that it's very good to give a second caller, like give the responsibility for someone, because first of all, you probably give it to someone who's already speaking, so he just is probably going to do it more. But the ideal scenario is that the whole team is kind of like always pulling their own weight when it comes down to this.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the best team I played in my career was obviously that last end team with Nerds, Dyr, St. Pius and Madden. And I think like it was like we had like three guys that would talk. Like Dyr wouldn't talk so much, but that was actually a good thing in a way, because we had a lot of communication on the other players, I would say. And
but he was like you could just rely on.
Yeah, he was more
reliable,
a soldier.
Getting it done.
Yes, exactly. And then I would say Nerds was like talking a lot around himself, which was good. St. Pius was a lot helping up with setting up utility as the AWP, and then Madden was very good at connecting with and talking in between players. So it was not really one person. So I think for sure, as Alexis said, I don't think you need a dedicated second guy at all. I think you just need, if you have skilled players, like they're going to do it in union.
Can we clear one thing up, Alexi, once and for all? Because the community love to say that like you and Imma are the ones fighting for voice and talking, you know, after that clip. It's just like, that's part of team, right?
I think, like, for me, the most ridiculous thing, because like we were laughing about it with Mihai after. It's like, it wasn't like directed to him, also, and it's just
taken out of context, and everyone else sits.
But
on
I
this.
Don't really care. I don't even care about the context. I just feel like whenever you have a team that is capable of winning or like is hungry to win, you always see it. And like I've seen, like I'm playing with Ukrainian team right now, like, and they understand Russian, and I've heard like so many clips of like these Russian teams when and they're like translating it to us, and I'm thinking like, okay, that's interesting to say to your teammate or something. So it's to me it's like can you say something better at times? Yes, but I think that if you compete, whether it's normal sports or this, and you never have those moments, like when you get frustrated or when you speak in a certain way to each other, it would be very weird that you could win, let's say. Because I feel like winning teams always have it. It's either behind closed doors or you hear it.
Sometimes it happens. Yeah.
I think it's a lot about respect. And I think, as Alex says, it's like there's a lot of snowflakes out there that doesn't understand that there's no time to sit and have a round table and a nice discussion and a coffee. Like there's not a time, there's no time for it. Like it's direct communication. So you're talking direct. And sometimes it leads to, you know, some small arguments, but I also think that proves some willingness to win. I mean, there's a certain line that you shouldn't go across, obviously, but I think, I mean, the best teams I've played in, we fought.
Like, yeah.
Not only me and one, like, everyone fought, like, in different, you know, constellations, and people would get mad and yell at each other in the prac room. And this is the best teams I've, like, personally played, and this would happen, like, on at least a monthly basis, like, that someone just full went mad at another guy.
I'm just, the thing I'm laughing about the most is just, like, if we had, like, when I played football,
yeah,
and like how our coach would scream to us.
Oh, bro, yeah.
It's like,
no.
So I have a boxing coach. When I was doing my kickboxing stuff, bro, that, the stuff he would say, like, you.
No, but that's the funniest thing, because I feel like it's always, I want to always be better. Like when I get frustrated, I'm always going to be there to like apologize if I cross the line or something, and always want to fix things in the right way and in the right manner. And I think that it's so much better than when I was 18, 19, 20, you know? Like, I've matured a lot since those days. But
you're getting older, mate.
Yeah. But the thing is that it's always a part of everything. And I think that, yeah, I mean, this, obviously the streams, like, they clip out something and it's fine. But they obviously also leave the bad stuff out. Like, I think a lot of teams are not allowing them to publish something.
Of course.
And that's even happened to us. Like, we got frustrated. It's part of the stuff that's happening.
Now, last couple of points to touch on with this for you guys. Stats of an IGL. What is, like, what do you guys consider? Because this stupid narrative I think a lot of people have, I think people who are not maybe playing to a high enough level don't seem to understand what is draining on you guys, right? So when you are calling more, when you are sometimes micromanaging things, when you are having to, obviously, it's going to be harder for you to focus on shooting. But they see some shots that an IGL will miss, and it's all IGLs get the same criticism. Oh, he didn't hit a easy shot. Like, how is he still playing? What would do you guys consider good enough? Just the end map win doesn't matter about stats, right? Or what is supposed to be something that we should be looking at as a metric of how we value an IGL in modern CS?
I would say that there's obviously a certain threshold that the in-game leader, like, he needs to be able to hold his own on his sides, right? Because at the end of the day, on CT, you are playing 5v5 CS, and yes, you're maybe 10% weaker than other players, but you need to be able, it cannot be like 40% weaker, right?
Okay.
So I think for me, in last year, I was playing very bad, like individually, and it wasn't good enough. Obviously, the team was not exactly functioning well, and I was focusing on a lot of stuff, and off the server, some stuff happened, but this is kind of where I saw it as, okay, that just wasn't good enough and I need to raise my individual level. But I think there is a lot of things that leads to the worst stats. Number one is obviously that you're focusing on your radar. You're constantly looking for how can we make a team play. You're not focusing on your crosshair a lot of the time, especially on T side. So there's, and you also most likely put yourself in the worst roles on set strats, because either you have the bomb or you're running first, usually, because this is kind of the roles that the other players don't want, right? And I think this is kind of what gives you the, like, actual proper excuse to have worse stats. But as I said, it also comes with a certain, there's a limit to how bad you can also play. And I think I was definitely above that limit last year.
Yeah, I do think that, like, as an IGL, when I played with, like, many lineups, many teams, when you have bad periods and bad games, like, I feel like I'm the worst enemy of myself. Like, I overthink, I'm very critical to myself. But the thing is, like, I understand when I played bad, like, very bad. And, like, sometimes we have, like, a half where, let's say you end with 3 kills or something. But you played, like, the whole half, I didn't, let's say I don't check stats, anything. I'm just, like, very happy with how we executed everything, like, we spoke about, how the moves we made, how trades happened. And you don't even think about it. And at one point, you know, you miss a frag that would win you the round and the opponent is on eco. and you're going to remember that round for the rest of the day, for tomorrow, the next day. It's like, I always put all these things into context. Like, as you said, sometimes it's unforgivable. You know, I'm thinking to myself, like, how did I miss this? Like, the whole game would be different. And at times I feel like, yeah, I might have missed a frag here and there, but putting everything to context, like how we played the rounds, how we spoke about some of the details, how I got traded, you know, you play selfless here and it worked. I couldn't, like, let's say we end a half, like we win 8-4 and I played good, but as a team we played bad compared to 8-4 and I played bad in terms of stats, but we did everything good as a team. I would take that any day. Because once you go to review it, you saw that so many things you did good and it's like good for the future, and not like you're watching the rounds and somebody's saving you out of like, you should have lost so hard here.
Yeah.
No, so it's like everything is about context, and you need to also, like you said, like understand when you did a mistake. And trust me, like, I think we do. Like, we hear it a lot, and yeah.
Is it a thankless job?
No, sorry? I don't think so. At times it is a thankless job.
You know, like you get, maybe not from your players and team, but from community side.
From
right?
The community, yes and no. When it goes good, everyone thinks you're the best. And when it goes bad, everyone thinks you're shit. But I think in a team, I think it's,
yeah, okay,
it's nice and giving.
I can like say one interesting thing. Like, I've seen some, like, trust me, there was a lot of hate comments I've seen from myself.
Yeah.
But like, there's a filter to it when it comes down to you. But like, I saw some like hate comments about Carrigan, for example, lately. And I don't agree. Like, if, I don't know, he's like, maybe I'm a bit biased because I always rated him as like, I guess the GOAT IGL, like after he kept it going when Glaive took a break and stuff.
Yeah.
But like, you have those down periods, and he started CS2 with having the best like CS2 team. He, you know, reached 2 major finals in a row at Shanghai. Obviously, after that, they've had ups and downs, but it's like, people are so, like, it's so easy to jump the gun. But I also think that maybe they should have gave some lineups more time in order to see the full potential. But as you see that, I don't want to speak about myself, but sometimes there is a lot of stuff that I'm reading and I understand how it is in reality, but they don't really. And that's like where I can say it. Like, I'm not defending myself, but I'm defending someone else to say, like, there's so much unnecessary stuff said and you don't know how it works actually. And I, you know, there's nothing you're going to say about it. Like, I'm not going to say anything about it publicly or anything, like any sports. Like, let's say football, for example, it's crazy what the fans are saying and how the amount of like haters there are.
The bigger we get, by the way, the worse it's going
to
get.
Exactly. So it's all part of the game, but it's annoying to read some comments when you clearly see that this guy either never played in a team environment
or just a face,
or he doesn't know how things work, or you know what I mean? It's like, I'm not diminishing like all the comments. Even if they're hating comments from the community, it's just that sometimes I might read a comment that's like, let's say, full of hate, or like, you understand this guy is coming with the wrong tone, but I read it and I'm like, oh yeah, he might understand something. Like, he had something like,
so there's something
like
there.
A good point. And like, you know, people can have their opinions, but that's like a good comment to read, even though he might talk shit about
it's
me
a good
or something.
Negative comment.
I'm just reading. It's like, yeah, this guy kind of knows what he's talking about. Like, you know what I mean? It goes both ways.
Yeah.
And then there are the people that are like too naive. Like, they are always speaking positive, and like, you know, when
it's like me about
the guy doesn't deserve credit. You know, maybe I don't care who he's speaking about, but it goes both ways.
Yeah.
And I just appreciate the comments that you understand the guy knows what he's talking about.
I always look at it this way. There's negative and positive comments, but the fact they're commenting is a good sign for us and the game in general for the audience, right? Like, the growth we have and where we're at now from, I don't know, 5-10 years ago is kind of crazy. So the last topic I have on here to talk about with you guys is probably Snappy's favorite thing in the whole world, the VRS. And you both shake your heads. So you're on both very different sides of this, right? Alexei, you're 13th in the VRS right now. Snappy, you had to grind from hell to the 26th rank right now, which is obviously respectable. But where are you guys at as not just leaders, but players on VRS? Snappy, I know it's your favorite topic.
Oh, no, I think people think that, like, the thing I actually think VRS in general is a very good thing.
Yeah.
I just think it needs to have some tweaks, right? Because the whole circuit was kind of, like, I guess, used as a test, like, without really having
a
lot of knowledge.
We were a live test, yeah.
Yeah, and then...
Guinea pig.
Yeah, and then the worst part I heard was actually the fact that it was Valve that blocked a lot of the qualifiers because some of the tournaments wanted to host qualifiers. I think one of the biggest things is with how VIS works and how it's calculated, it has a mechanism basically that if you lose to lower ranked opponents, it will haunt you for pretty much 7 months in the head-to-head, right? And this is where it kind of is impossible to replace the teams at the top. I don't think we have seen a single team get replaced, and I don't think that's due to level. Mm-hmm. I think that's due to the fact that, I mean, you can see it now, right? I don't think Liquid and VP almost have won a game until Fissure now the entire season. And then they win a few games and they're just so far above every other team.
Yeah, 110 points.
That's below them. And I think if you gave a chance to, let's say, a Fnatic, for example, that has been on a run, I think they for sure would have probably, if given more chances, done better, right? I think the main criticism is the fact that there needs to be a way to replace teams. Because what the teams are doing at the top is they're just dodging. Like, mm-hmm. they're just making sure we only play teams above us, which is, like, if I'm a lower-ranked team in the Tier 1 circuit, I'll just not expose myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they don't expose themselves to anyone except, like, Na'Vi and above, then I can't lose points.
Yeah,
and as long as I just win 4 matches a season, I won't go out of the system. And this is kind of the main critique, that you get plus 100 points for winning a game. And, like, even bad Tier 2 teams will do surprises.
Yeah, of course.
They will get a couple of games against a number 12 team or a number 8 team that's in bad form at these LAN tournaments. So there needs to be a way where it's figured out how you can kind of get the teams that are better into the circuit. I think that's kind of where the Val ranking needs to be addressed. It's one of the bigger ones, at least. And then I also just think it was kind of stupid that, like, qualifiers was essentially blocked. I think they're blocked until April 2026 for certain tournament formats, right? Some tournament formats can have it, but there's a reason why it's not allowed. From what I understood, PGL got they got an extension for Valve to do qualifiers for the first ones, Astana and Bucharest. But then after, there wasn't, because they were only granted the permission for so long, right? And then it went back to only invite, because the tournament format required them, I think, to have half of the teams or something like that coming through qualifier. I'm not sure about the full details, but it's something like this, right? And then obviously, if you're a tournament organizer, like, you still want the best teams, so you don't want to invite. Like, you still want to invite maybe 75%, mm-hmm. right? So I think this is kind of some of the issues. But in general, I think it's a system that needs to be figured out. I thought the partner system was good. People kind of don't understand the fact that there was one TO that I was against because it was like purely like partner, right? But I always thought it was a good way to, if I don't know if it was the best way, but it definitely wasn't a bad way for teams to earn money and want to invest into CS. So what the best solution is, I'm not certain about, but obviously I think and hope that there's going to be made improvements over the next 6 months.
Do you believe, though, that it's something that can be polished and that can improve where we're at in an ecosystem for the game?
I think it can definitely be polished and improved, but I think both TOs, organizations, especially Valve, like, Valve needs to step up, but the TOs and organizations need to find a way where they can make it profitable for all parties. Because at the end of the day, the key is that everyone wants to and everyone needs to earn some money in order to make it sustainable. So the best solution is to find that way. And I don't know, obviously, what the best way to get there is.
Yeah. Alexei, for you.
I think that Snappy understands way more than me. I think they needed to struggle with it. And I remember the invite thing I heard about when you were at that 12th, 13th, 14th place where you didn't reach an invite to the tournament and couldn't get invited. Just there was some messy thing.
Yeah.
I think it was, for me, it's the biggest things are exactly the dodging that you can avoid playing and, you know, not get punished by it. And some teams can like go to tournaments that and farm points. I don't know, like there, it's so weird at times. And then you have like in this tournament, right?
Yep.
We play our first game against 9 and we just check that. I'm not sure about their BRS. What's their BRS ranking?
Oh, I think off the top 30, of my head, 40, they might be like 40.
Because like if they win us, it's like check. Probably like plus 50 something points. So like why wouldn't they then get way more? Someone can just immediately like explain to me why, but it just feels like, let's say they would get 1 million points by winning us. It's like, what's in it for us to play then?
Okay, you know, 9 is 36, so I was not too far off.
Because it would be nice that, you know, better teams could play some lower tournaments and not like risk their spot, like you're saying, like everybody's dodging then. But I think it has been getting improvements, and I do think that it's going to be better, hopefully the best thing there ever is, like in 2 years, hopefully. But, you know, it's still a process, and you would hope that there is like the optimal way, like the optimal ranking system.
We're all waiting for it. Snappy's that's the smile and saying it.
No, but like I think it is, as Alexi say, like you don't, when you're a top team, essentially what you don't want to do is you don't want to expose yourself to other teams except if it's LAN, because if you go to LAN, yeah, like the LAN factor will then get you
a big win.
And then like, but there's a lot of things, obviously, the event weight is what kind of decides some of these other factors as to the points you get. But where you really get punished is on the head-to-head, right? Because every loss that you get on the head-to-head get compared for the starting rank, right? And that is where the lower-ranked teams, those losses, like last year, I think we had, like with the games we played with Jax, like if you looked 4 months later, we had minus 150 points for these losses because they were like hitting us so hard because our rank had gotten up so far because we qualified for a standard, then we got 80, then we won frag, then we got 40, then we got playoff at a standard, then we got 20. But then all those losses we had 4 or 5 months ago, they punish you because they came against very bad teams that maybe had like 700 VIS or maybe some of them even disbanded. And that would be a maximum punishment on the head-to-head, right? And this is why it's so unforgiving.
It's so unforgiving
for the tier two teams to get out, because essentially every loss you catch is haunting you for 7 months.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And this is why it's so unforgiving for the tier two teams to get out, and why like it's only the 10 best like things that count in each category, right? And when Liquid catch a win now, they're doing it at an event rate of 1, because a $1 million event will essentially get 1 event rate. And then all the other multipliers, because they have barely won any matches.
Yeah, they so suddenly boost them.
They get points in all the categories, and that's why they suddenly get 100 points. And then you see other teams, they go to a LAN, but they have already maximized the opponent network and all of these other scores online, right? So yeah, it's a big, you need to actually look into it to really understand it, but yeah.
And it must, I don't think it's simple.
No, definitely
because
not,
then
man.
It would be probably.
Snappy's a smart cookie with this stuff.
Yeah, but it,
you don't have to deal with it as much.
No, I think as long as you are a team like Na'Vi, all you need to know is don't expose yourself online. if you do
avoid
that,
the online
events, there's likely zero chance you fall out.
Yeah.
Well, guys, this has been fantastic. I've enjoyed this very much. So thank you very much for coming and talking through all of this. I got to learn a lot with it as well. This has been the All About Counter-Strike Star Series special, being hosted here in Budapest. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you at the tournament.